72 to 75. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly cloudy with temperatures in the low to mid 70s. You can answer our question of the week. What TV shows have you been into recently? Text us 218-326-1234.
There were lots of transactions he was doing to run his sex trafficking operation. And he was also valuable in helping to bring business to the bank.
An investigation sheds light on the ties between accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein and J.P. Morgan.
For Tuesday, September 9th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. U.S. employers are adding far fewer jobs than initially tallied, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
The revision comes as President Trump is casting doubts on the integrity of BLS.
We need accurate numbers. We need truthful and honest data, which is why the president took the monumental step to try and appoint and confirm new leadership at the BLS.
And we hear from some of NPR's Student Podcast Challenge finalists.
One high schooler details the steps that he took to write his first love song.
Right now, with everything I've known in my 16 years of life, I don't think there's anything more beautiful than falling in love.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The Supreme Court has cleared the way to consider a challenge to President Trump's tariff policies. The High Court will hear arguments in the case in the first week of November. NPR's Elena Moore has details.
This case centers on a move Trump made back in April when he announced sweeping tariffs on countries around the world using the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. It marked a stark break from precedent, given that Congress, not the White House, traditionally controls the country's tariff moves. Two federal courts have since said the policy is illegal. Now, if the Supreme Court sides with Trump, the tariffs would be allowed to stay. But if the justices uphold the lower court rulings, the White House could be forced to refund the billions it's already collected from the tariffs. Elena Moore, NPR News.
President Trump has issued a statement expressing his disapproval with the recent Israeli strikes on Hamas targets in Qatar. Qatar is a U.S. ally and has been a key player in negotiations aimed at ending the war in Gaza. The Missouri State House has advanced a plan that would redraw the state's congressional voting map as requested by President Trump. It goes to the state Senate next. St. Louis Public Radio's Brian Munoz reports.
Republicans say what they're calling the Missouri First map better reflects the will of the state's mostly Republican voters in next year's midterm election. Democrats, however, warn it could unfairly favor the GOP and dilute the power of Kansas City voters. Ashley Onney is a House minority leader.
We knew coming into this special session we would lose. We knew that, but we showed up and we will keep showing up because the fight didn't end today. There's a lot of fight left. Missouri's just the latest, but it's happening all over the country.
The bill now moves to the Missouri Senate, where it is expected to pass later this week. For NPR News, I'm Brian Munoz in Jefferson City, Missouri.
New national test scores are out today. These measure 8th graders' science skills and 12th graders' math and reading skills. NPR's Sequoia Carrillo has details.
These test scores are part of the National Assessment for Educational Progress, also known as the nation's report card, and they come in the wake of massive cuts to the U.S. Education Department. Math scores for students in the 12th grade dropped 3 points from the previous test in 2019, while 8th graders followed a similar pattern with a 4-point average drop in science. In both science and math, drops happened across all achievement levels, so low and high performing students dropped this cycle. Reading scores also dipped for nearly all 12th graders compared to the last test. But when you compare these scores to the first nation's report card for 12th grade reading more than 30 years ago, today's average score is 10 points lower. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 196, the NASDAQ gained 80, the S&P 500 gained 17. This is NPR. In Arizona, the National Park Service says a wildland firefighter has died fighting the Dragon Bravo fire near the Grand Canyon. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports that massive wildfire has been burning since July 4th.
The firefighter's name has not been released, but federal fire managers say he died after suffering a cardiac emergency near the entrance to the north rim of the Grand Canyon while doing what's called suppression repair. That's when crews try to rehab land, like reducing erosion around fire lines, after a fire has raced through it. The Park Service, in conjunction with the local coroner's office, is investigating the death. The Dragon Bravo fire was sparked by lightning more than 2 months ago and has burned some 145,000 acres and destroyed a historic lodge. Another bigger investigation is focused on whether the National Park Service, hit with staffing and funding cuts from President Trump's DOGE team, had adequate resources to respond to the fire. Kirk Siegler, NPR News.
A man accused in last month's fatal stabbing of Ukrainian refugee 23-year-old Irina Zarutska on a North Carolina commuter train now faces federal charges in the death. The Justice Department case is charging the suspect with causing death on a mass transportation system, meaning he could face the death penalty. DeCarlos Brown Jr. has a lengthy arrest record with 14 prior criminal cases. Ford is recalling almost 1.5 million vehicles in the U.S. from model years 2015 to 19. At issue, a problem in the rear view camera. Among the affected vehicles, Lincolns, Mustangs, and Expeditions. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 5:06. All drivers can help reduce pedestrian vehicle crashes on Minnesota's roads by watching for pedestrians, stop for crossing pedestrians at every single corner, and pay attention and be prepared to stop for pedestrians. It is the law. Brought to you by the Minnesota Departments of Transportation and Public Safety. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Right now, we continue with All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein is still dominating the news 6 years after his death in prison. A House committee just released a book of notes sent to Epstein for his 50th birthday. One has an outline drawing of a female body, and at the bottom appears the name Donald J. Trump with a signature. The White House insists the signature and the note are not the president's. Separately, a New York Times investigation spent months following the money from Epstein to the country's leading bank, J.P. Morgan Chase. The article concludes that the bank enabled his crimes even as evidence against him piled up. Matt Goldstein is one of the reporters who worked on the story. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
How valuable were Jeffrey Epstein's accounts with J.P. Morgan?
You know, they're valuable in the sense, obviously, he had a lot of money there. At the peak, he had about $300 million in his accounts. But you have to view him more than just the dollars. There were lots of transactions he was doing, obviously, to run his sex trafficking operation for so many years. And he was also valuable in helping to bring business to the bank because his stock and trade was connecting people. You know, it's always unclear exactly how much he did in terms of bringing new business into the bank, but clearly he was very important in making introductions to some people at the bank.
You write that he seemed to know everyone. Can you give us a couple examples?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's been well known that Leslie Wexner, who was the head of the limited Victoria's Secret, was his number one client. They had also already been a client of J.P. Morgan, but that obviously further cemented the relationship. Later on, he had connections with Sergey Brin from Google, Bill Gates, who never became a client, but they were working on a potential deal for Bill Gates and his foundation. Leon Black, obviously, was a big, important client to Epstein and was a client of the bank. There's some debate over how much he introduced Benjamin Netanyahu to the bank, and Ehud Barak was also a person that he knew.
Leaders of Israel, yeah.
Yeah.
You say that even before investigations into Epstein became public, warning lights should have been flashing inside J.P. Morgan. Explain why.
Yeah, so, you know, he really becomes essentially what they call a private bank client in 1998. And that's like a special kind of role. It's not like you or me going to a bank and having a checking account or like having to call 1-800 number on our credit card if we have a problem. And by 2003, they're already seeing a lot of big cash transactions being pulled out. Huge ones, as much as $175,000, $1.7 million altogether by 2004. And this was money that was going to largely to make payments to women and people in his social circle. And the bank had an awareness of this, of where the money was going, and that should have raised more flags internally.
So what pushback was there within the bank?
Well, there was pushback. Early on, it starts, there are some people on the compliance and the anti-money laundering side who start to flag some of these transactions. They write emails, they're raising concerns. But at this point, he's become a favored and important customer of this person, Jess Staley, who's a very critical and high-rising employee at the bank. And he basically vouches for Epstein. And what you start to have is this pattern where he vouches for Epstein. He says, there's no problem here. I know this guy. These things are okay. Don't worry about them. And it's maybe it's a little bit of human nature, but people sort of defer also according to his rank in the bank. So basically, the concerns don't really get elevated or go anywhere.
Did Staley respond to your request for comment for this story?
No, he didn't. He, which I can tell you has been consistent throughout. Staley or his lawyers have never responded in any way.
In 2019, after Epstein was arrested in New Jersey and charged with federal sex trafficking offenses, J.P. Morgan filed a report retroactively flagging some 4,700 Epstein transactions as suspicious, totaling more than $1 billion. What was going on there, and how should those transactions have been handled in real time?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the crux here. That sort of shows that it's easy, obviously, to go back in time. And, you know, and J.P. Morgan will tell you, well, we did the right thing. We went back and analyzed the reports and looked at them in a fresh light. But it's also clear that they could have done this back then. I mean, to in fairness to J.P. Morgan, they were following some of these suspicious activities reports along the way, but not with the same kind of frequency that they should have, judged by the $1.1 billion report that they filed. If you want to sum up the problem here, it's sort of like an institutional fail. There are people along the way on at least four different occasions who raise the point there's a big reputational risk about us keeping him here, but no one feels they have either the power or they want to actually take that next step and say, okay, it's time to exit him from the bank.
Well, what has J.P. Morgan said in response to your reporting?
You know, they've stuck largely to the same party line, which has been they're very sorry about their relationship with Epstein. They're sorry that they ever did business with him and that it went on too long, but they firmly state that they had no idea they were helping to basically funnel money for his sex trafficking. And largely, they've thrown the blame on this guy, Jess Staley. And they basically say they put too much faith in Staley, and if it wasn't for Staley, they would have exited him earlier. It's, you know, there's some truth to that, but it also becomes a convenient excuse, too.
So your story gives us some glimpse into the special treatment that the ultra-wealthy can receive from major banks. What's your biggest takeaway from investigating that world?
Yeah, like I said, it's this idea of the very close relationship nature of it. And it's sort of like, as we can all relate it to our own friends, that we can sometimes have blind spots about things that our friends do that we don't like or that we find hard to reconcile with. You have to be a little bit more dispassionate, particularly in terms of finance. And quite frankly, banks' jobs is to look for things like sex trafficking, to look for things like money laundering. And when you see a predominance kind of these kind of huge, hefty transactions going on a regular basis, time and time again, at some point, someone should say, you know, we got to pull the trigger here. You know, even if we are not totally convinced he's doing something wrong, it just doesn't smell right.
That's New York Times business reporter Matt Goldstein. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ari.
High school is a time of exploration when young people try to find and define their place in the world. And those explorations, well, they can make for great podcast opportunities. Our education team got to listen to the entries for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge, and the judges have narrowed them down to the best of those podcasts. Here's NPR's Janadu Zhongli with two of our high school finalists.
How do you show your love to someone?
David Reyes is a student musician and songwriter at J. Sterling Morton East High School in Cicero, Illinois.
Is it by buying them flowers, taking them on a date, writing them a letter, or maybe it's by making them a song?
David says he's always loved music, listening and playing his favorite songs on the acoustic guitar. But he says he never thought to write his own until he fell in love.
Will we still be friends? Right now, with everything I've known in my 16 years of life, I don't think there's anything more beautiful than falling in love.
So he set out to make something beautiful, which also became the title of his podcast that follows the steps he took to write his first love song.
I pick up my guitar and I start fiddling with the chords I think fit the sound I'm looking for. I like how that sounds, so I'll work with it.
Like many students his age, David says he isn't sure yet where his music will take him. But for now, he says he's going to take it slow and focus on enjoying himself.
I'll keep learning things as I go along, try new sounds as they come across, and explore as much as I can. And maybe one day, I'll be able to say that I've made something beautiful.
Promise me you'll miss me.
In another one of our finalist podcasts, Owen Aberg discovered something beautiful in his own life.
Having a cleft is a struggle. And even among kids born with them, I'm a special case.
Owen is a senior at Delta High School in Richland, Washington, and he was born with a bilateral cleft palate.
Or to be put in layman's terms, you're born with a hole in your face.
He says his life has been a journey from the get-go.
Of going from surgery, school, dentist trip, surgery again, and more. It's hard for me and my mom.
Years later, he wanted to know, what was it really like for his mom when she found out about his cleft?
I had to know as much as I could. I had to prepare myself as best I could. I had to be ready to keep you alive.
Keep him alive by making sure her newborn could open his mouth and get enough nutrients. Luckily, she was able to get support from family and medical professionals who weren't too far away.
But me being the person I am, I had to be there, always.
Owen says growing up, he learned about other kids with his condition, including a 7-year-old girl in his home state who was abandoned by her parents. And in his own life, he's been treated differently because of the surgery scars on his face. He says all this made him feel more grateful for his mom and his life.
Having a cleft has always been what made me different, but I never wanted it to be what defined me as a person. I'm sure that every other person with a cleft would agree. Thank you.
These are two of our 10 high school finalists. Our judges will announce our grand prize winner later this month. Janet Ujung Lee, NPR News.
Support for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge comes from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, a story on Wikipedia. They have often faced criticism for accuracy, but now the attacks are becoming political. One reporter says that's putting Wikipedia at risk. Also, the latest from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at our website, kaxc.org. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. We also thank the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. KAXE and Stay Human present The Authentic Voice, a live storytelling concert Saturday, September 20th, 7 p.m. at Clacko Brewing in Grand Rapids. The event features nationally known storyteller Laura Nemi and some of Stay Human's regular contributors, made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet Sunday, September 14th at the Buck Lake Community Center, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January. Deadline to apply is October 1st. Visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. There's more ahead from All Things Considered on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters this Friday. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. With over 7 million English language entries, Wikipedia, the entirely volunteer-edited online encyclopedia, has been called the biggest database of human knowledge in the world. It is consistently one of the most visited websites in the world, and in its nearly 25-year history, the huge variety of topics on the site have been criticized for being crowdsourced, frivolous, and inaccurate. But in his recent article for The Verge, Josh Jezza argues that Wikipedia is one of the last bastions of objective, accurate information to be found on the internet, and he says that Wikipedia is under attack from political forces who want to shape its content. Josh joins us now. Welcome.
Hi.
So before we get started, I do just want to acknowledge that NPR's CEO, Catherine Marr, was previously the CEO of the Wikimedia Foundation. Josh, your piece opens with this anecdote. It's from Inauguration Day back in January, and that is when a prominent Trump ally, Elon Musk, made straight-arm gestures at an inauguration event. And those gestures, to many observers, appeared to be a Nazi salute. And I'm sure many people probably remember there was this massive global debate over how to interpret what Musk did. And that was a debate that was also playing out on Wikipedia. Can you just tell us what it looked like there?
Yeah, it was interesting. The debate on Wikipedia looks a lot like the debate everywhere else initially. You had people who believed strongly it was a Nazi salute, people who believed that it wasn't. There was a huge amount of debate. It ended up being about 7,000 words over several days to settle a couple sentences, but it was remarkable given what was happening in the rest of the media and on social media, that people more or less came to a consensus about something they could all live with.
Now, this is, of course, just one incident, one moment in time, but what does it tell us more broadly about the type of community that Wikipedia is?
Wikipedia is governed by process. It's developed a lot of rules over the years, kind of in response to all the challenges of open online discourse. And the core ones are basically that any assertion needs to have a source. It should be evaluated for its reliability. You should try to stay neutral and that you can't do your own original research. And that coupled with a bunch of ground rules of how you should discuss things, that you should work towards consensus, that you should avoid personal attacks, things like that, means that really contentious topics kind of steers towards some consensus rather than splitting apart into factions or dissolving into anarchy.
Wikipedia is supported by donations. So that means, as you note in the piece, that there is no existing government funding to cut off. There are no advertisers to boycott. And even so, the site, as well as its editors that are volunteers, have come under threat from government officials around the world. Can you give us some examples of what that has looked like elsewhere outside of the United States?
Yeah, so at the outset of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you had accusations from politicians and state-aligned media that the site was biased, anti-Russian, promulgating fake news, things like that. At the same time, you had online vigilantes who were exposing and harassing editors of Wikipedia. You had legal action. The state declared one editor a foreign agent. You had some of the people who were doxxed be arrested. And so it was kind of this multi-pronged attack. At the same time, you had people trying to edit it towards a Russian perspective.
The Trump administration has directly challenged the legitimacy of Wikipedia. Why do you think that is?
I think you can see it as part of a larger attack against independent media, against journalism, against academia. Wikipedia is one of these institutions that, you know, it's quite stubbornly fact-based and is tremendously popular and tremendously influential. I mean, it's the first thing many people say, even at a time when many people don't trust the media. People generally trust Wikipedia.
We've been speaking with Josh Jezza of The Verge. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The U.S. job market is suddenly looking a lot weaker than expected. The government says employers hired nearly a million fewer people than initially reported in the 12 months that ended in March. Now, that number is not surprising, but it does give President Trump more ammunition for his attacks on the agency that produced it. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is with me now. Hey, Maria.
Hey, Mary Louise.
A million people sounds like a lot to be off by. What happened?
It is a huge number. Technically, it's 911,000 fewer people that employers hired through the 12 months ending in March. That's fewer than previously reported.
Okay.
And that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the government agency that puts out this data every year. It is the largest revision on record since 2000. And the size of the revision was somewhat expected, as you said, but it does prove that the economy coming into this year and the economy that President Trump inherited from President Biden was a lot shakier than it looked at the time. That said, a couple of caveats. This is still a preliminary report, and it is routine. The government puts out this revision every year, but this year it's getting a lot of attention, and not necessarily just because of that big number.
Right. It's that big number, but also what, because of where, like which agency the number is coming from?
Indeed, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or the BLS. As you know, last month, after the BLS published a weaker-than-expected jobs report, Trump fired its head, claiming, without evidence, that the agency was manipulating the numbers to make his economy look bad. Now he's nominated a conservative economist to replace her, and the White House is jumping on today's numbers to argue that case. Here's White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt at a press briefing today.
We need accurate numbers. We need truthful and honest data, which is why the president took the monumental step to try and appoint and confirm new leadership at the BLS so we can have data that we can actually rely on.
But many already do rely on this data. Economists across the political spectrum, the Federal Reserve, business owners, they all rely on the U.S. government to provide the best possible, most accurate, unbiased data about the state of the U.S. economy. And now it's Trump's attacks on the BLS that are making many worried that they won't be able to rely on its data anymore.
Although, Maria, does President Trump have a point? This is a really big revision, 911,000 people. I mean, shouldn't that raise questions? Questions about the BLS?
Well, it is the agency's job to regularly check and publicly revise its data. For example, for the monthly jobs report, the BLS starts with the data that it gets from a sampling of employers, but then eventually it gets more complete data from state tax records and can provide a bigger picture. Those regular updates have traditionally built trust and confidence in the economy and its data. It's not supposed to be political or politicized.
I see. Well, taking the politics out of all this, for all of us, for ordinary Americans, what do these revised jobs numbers mean?
Well, short term, it probably means we're definitely going to get lower interest rates. The Federal Reserve was already widely expected to cut rates next week. And now with this new evidence that the job market hasn't been doing so well, it seems all but certain. Longer term, it means the economy is even more uncertain than it was feeling. And President Trump has made a lot of dramatic economic changes since March, and that's creating even more instability on top of what we now know was already unsteady.
NPR's Maria Aspen, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. weather tonight, patchy fog with lows 49 to 56. And tomorrow, patchy fog in the morning, then becoming sunny with highs 72 to 75. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly cloudy, temperatures in the low to mid 70s. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and 7 o'clock, Deborah Ann, your volunteer host for On the River.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A 35-year-old woman died in a three-vehicle car crash in Virginia on Friday. The Mesabi Tribune says the crash on 2nd Avenue North was reported just before 3 p.m. Law enforcement found one of the drivers unresponsive, and she did not appear to be breathing. She was later pronounced dead. The two other drivers suffered non-life-threatening injuries. The Tribune reported Friday that the crash was still under investigation. The University of Minnesota's service workers' impending strike has made headlines over the past few weeks, but some Grand Rapids residents may have been surprised to see a picket line when the strike began Tuesday. Six members of Teamsters Local 320 picketed alongside Highway 169. They do maintenance, grounds, and agricultural work at the U's North Central Research and Outreach Center, which shares a campus with Minnesota North College Itasca. The six are just a small part of the open-ended strike. Some 1,400 workers across at least eight campuses are asking for fair wages and other protections. The university says the demands are, quote, unrealistic in today's financial landscape. Billy O'Brien has been a maintenance and operations mechanic for 3 years and has worked at NICROC for 10. He says they're striking for equal pay and standardized contracts to increase future negotiating leverage. But they're also out there to fight for college campus workers that haven't gotten the treatment he says they deserve.
We were close to negotiating a good contract. I felt there's just a little bit more that some of the people feel that the university can give. And we're going to try to get that. So
the union says over 80% of workers rejected the university's last offer Friday. Minnesota is joining a growing list of Democratic-leaning states standing up for access to vaccines. Governor Tim Walz issued an executive order Monday. It directs the state departments of health and commerce to figure out how to make sure Minnesotans keep receiving vaccines. The order comes amid quickly changing federal recommendations under Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a prominent anti-vaxxer. The Minnesota Reformer reports that Colorado, Massachusetts, New Mexico, New York, and Pennsylvania issued similar orders after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration said it would limit who can get the COVID-19 vaccine. According to a news release from Walz, Minnesota pharmacists can still give the vaccine, regardless of the recommendations. The reformer says Walz's order is slightly less aggressive than other states. The health department's medical director should issue an order on COVID vaccine access within the next 2 weeks. The department's health insurers and providers have to meet by October 6th to come up with a plan to address barriers to vaccine access. Zebra mussels have been confirmed in three more northern Minnesota lakes. The Department of Natural Resources announced the finding of adult zebra mussels in Roosevelt Lake in Outing and Swan Lake in Pengilly on Tuesday, as well as the discovery of veligers in White Earth Lake near White Earth. White Earth Nation invasive species staff found the veligers or larvae in water samples. The discovery suggests a reproducing population, though adult zebra mussels have not yet been found. The DNR reminds boaters that clean, drain, dry rules are state law. Find more on preventing the spread of aquatic invasive species at mndnr.gov/AIS. The Minnesota Department of Transportation is hosting an open house on Highway 169 road safety improvements. The agency is looking at the four-lane stretches of the road in Itasca County. The goal of the safety audit is to identify safety issues and propose short, medium, and long-term strategies to address them. Staff will be at the open house at the Nyberg Community Center in Coleraine to answer questions and hear feedback. The event starts at 5 p.m. Thursday with a short presentation at 5:15. Find more information and other ways to comment at kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. There are shocking scenes out of Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, today. Parliament on fire. Protesters have attacked politicians and set fire to the airport, too. The prime minister has quit. NPR's Dia Hadid is following this from her base in Mumbai. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
What happened today?
Well, the latest is that in a brief address, the Army Chief of Staff, General Ashok Raj Sigdel, urged protesters to calm down. But minutes after he spoke, the Nepali Army issued a harsher warning to its Facebook page, and it warned them to stand down and said it would take control of the situation.
What would it mean for Nepal's army to take control of the situation?
It's not clear. This is all unprecedented. So we're watching and waiting. I mean, Ari, today was shocking by Nepali standards. It was like the country unraveled. As you mentioned, protesters set fire to the parliament, to government institutions across the country. And this all happened as the prime minister resigned, as the interior minister had already left his job. So it wasn't even clear who was in charge. And it's not now clear if protesters will heed the army's call because they're furious. To give you a sense, we spoke to one protester who was watching the Nepali parliament burn down. Her name is Sonik Kumar. She works full-time. She makes $85 a month to support her studies. Her family's too poor to pitch in.
They have killed so many innocent lives. We want politicians to be killed as well.
She's telling us she wants them to be shot dead.
Really shocking to hear this woman say she wants politicians to be killed as well. What are the protesters so angry about?
Primarily, they're angry because on Monday, security forces killed 19 protesters. Now, human rights activists have criticized Nepali forces for acting with impunity in the past, but nothing like this. And the fury didn't begin there. In fact, it had been bubbling up for a while through a campaign called Nepo Kids.
What is that campaign?
It's quite similar to what you might imagine in the American context. But for weeks now, Nepali social media users were sharing images uploaded by the children of Nepali elites. One of the most memorable was a politician's son who posed beside a Christmas tree that was made of Louis Vuitton boxes. This is in a country where most people don't make more than $2,500 a year. So one activist who asked to remain anonymous because she's afraid of being targeted by authorities explained it like this.
Children of politicians started posting about their Gucci lifestyles, their Louis Vuitton lifestyles, where people started actually comparing. And where are we as people?
Where are we as people? And then the government shut down most social media on Thursday. They said it was because those platforms had not registered with authorities, but it enraged Nepalis, who saw it as a government trying to shut them down. So students called for protests on Monday.
And so now, with the army threatening to take over, the country's leaders having left their jobs, and the most important buildings on fire, where do things go from here?
I asked somebody smarter than me. Ashish Pradhan is from the International Crisis Group. He told me the big issue right now, the big question is who in Nepal actually has the legitimacy to govern? And he says that because protesters targeted the whole Nepali political class.
this is pretty unprecedented, especially because of the scale. It hasn't been just targeted at the current leadership or the current ruling coalition. It's been across the board. But that raises really big questions about what follows next.
You'll note everybody is saying unprecedented, and these are unprecedented times for Nepal. So we're all watching to see what might happen next.
NPR's Dia Hadid, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Ari.
For baseball fans, Sandy Koufax is an almost mythical figure. In the 1960s, playing for the Los Angeles Dodgers, he put together what is considered the greatest five-year span for a pitcher in baseball history. One of his most remarkable achievements happened 60 years ago tonight when he pitched a perfect game. Steve Futterman looks back.
It was a warm Thursday evening at Dodger Stadium.
Tonight, September the 9th, 1965.
Sandy Koufax had thrown three no-hitters in the three previous years. But on this night against the Chicago Cubs, he was trying to make it the rarest of no-hitters. A perfect game. No walks, no errors. 27 batters up, 27 batters out.
Through eight innings, he has pitched a perfect game. He has struck out 11. He has retired 24 consecutive batters.
I didn't become aware that it was a perfect game until probably the seventh inning.
On that evening, Wes Parker was the Dodgers' first baseman.
The bottom of the seventh inning, Jimmy LaFever, who was a rookie that year, and I were sitting next to each other on the bench. He said, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Are you?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Do you want the ball to be hit to you?" He said, "No." And he said, "Do you want it to be hit to you?" I said, "No."
It is 9:41 p.m. on September the 9th.
Legendary announcer Vin Scully was broadcasting the game for the Dodgers. His play-by-play calls only added to the game's iconic status. In the ninth inning, he began giving the time.
Sandy reading signs into his windup, 2-2 pitch. Fastball got him swinging.
The first batter up, Chris Krug, struck out.
Here is Joe Amalfitano to pinch hit for Don Kessinger.
That was the 26th victim. He got the last six guys via the strikeout.
Joe Amalfitano came up with one out. He'd previously had some success against Koufax, not this night.
0-2 to Amalfitano. The strike two pitch to Joe. Fastball swung on and missed, strike three.
Amalfitano, now 91, remembers the exact pitch.
And then come this fastball. I couldn't hit it with a telephone pole. I swung and missed.
For fans at the game, the memories are still crystal clear.
The time on the scoreboard is 9:44.
Sandy Koufax was my favorite person in the whole world, and I was at the Dodgers game that day.
Mark Warshauer now teaches at the University of California at Irvine. He was 11 years old and attended with his dad.
Over the last two innings, it was just explosive. Every single pitch, every single strike was just absolutely electric.
He is one out away from the promised land, and Harvey Keene is coming up.
Joe Amalfitano had a brief discussion with Harvey Keene, who knew what was about to happen.
Now I'm going back to the dugout, and Harvey says, "Joe, how's he throwing?" I says, "You better be ready. He's getting it up there." And Harvey said, "This is classic. Wait for me, I'll be right back."
It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene. One strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. A perfect game.
As the Dodgers celebrated, the first baseman, Wes Parker, was just glad it was over.
Thank God I didn't screw it up. Relief.
Mark Warshauer often tells people he was at the game.
It has to be my greatest sports thrill. Certainly as a fan, nothing comes close to this.
And infielder Joe Amalfitano often speaks with Koufax on September 9th.
I always call him on the 9th for years. We reminisce. He's a wonderful guy, high-class guy.
We reached out to Sandy Koufax through a representative. He declined to talk. Now, as a reporter, I like to report, and in most cases, I don't like to be part of my stories. I will make a slight exception at the very end for this one. I was also at Sandy Koufax's perfect game. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This past summer's box office was sluggish, but over the weekend, Hollywood found help, thanks to The Devil. The Conjuring Last Rites ended up having the top horror movie opening of all time, NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
The devil has come to Pennsylvania.
In the latest Conjuring movie, paranormal investigators and demonologist Ed and Lorraine Warren are back.
There's something in the attic.
This time, they and their daughter help a terrorized family whose home is haunted.
This thing in your house is a demon.
It was so exciting. It was really fun to watch.
Bobby Bagby-Ford is president and chief creative officer of B&B Theaters, which operates 58 cinemas around the country, mostly in the Midwest. She says moviegoers were so excited, they came in groups and lingered in the lobbies to debrief.
And then we were also seeing on social it blow up and people tagging people to saying, you've got to see this, let's go together. It really changed the trajectory of September, really, this weekend did.
Before now, many analysts were predicting a sleepy September at the box office after a somewhat slow summer, even though it kicked off with a bang in May. Disney's live-action remake of Lilo and Stitch and the latest installment of Mission Impossible took in $1.6 billion worldwide combined.
The Memorial Weekend was incredible. You had what was called Mission Stitch Possible because two huge movies opened on that weekend and powered a record-breaking haul.
Paul DeGarabedian is a senior media analyst for Comscore, which specializes in analyzing the box office.
So when you have something like that, everyone thinks, wow, we're going to easily get to, let's say, a $4 billion summer, and it just didn't happen. Those are the ups and downs of the box office.
He says while there were some bright spots over the summer, the newest Superman movie, Jurassic World Rebirth, F1, and Weapons, other movies just didn't bring as many people to the theaters.
Not every movie resonated as many had hoped.
Then this past weekend, Warner Brothers' new Conjuring movie made $194 million worldwide on opening weekend.
It was definitely a surprise that it opened this high.
Daniel Luria is senior vice president of the box office company, which analyzes data from studios and theaters. He says the movie was big with Hispanic moviegoers, an audience that tends to enjoy watching horror movies and family titles. For The Conjuring Last Rites, he says, Latinos represented 40% of the ticket buyers on opening weekend, mostly in the Southwest. The movie also made $13.3 million in Mexico.
I wouldn't discount the faith-based side of a movie like this. I know that sounds a little bit ironic considering it's movies about demons and haunted houses, but at least, you know, I'm Mexican myself, and looking at Mexican culture, we have a lot of lore and a lot of mythology about these sort of stories within our culture, right? I know, you know, whether we look at it in a strictly religious lens or not, the fact that it has this as a backdrop usually has a connection with Hispanic audiences.
Next weekend, the anime movie Demon Slayer: Infinity Castle could continue the momentum. And looking ahead, Bobby Bagby-Ford says the movie theater business is far from dead.
And the rest of this year looks really fun. So many nights of popcorn eating opportunities, as well as next year, looks really, really, really strong. And so I think people need to stop writing our obituary and look at all the glimmers of joy that are coming out over the next 24 months.
She has high hopes for Wicked for Good, Zootopia 2, and the new Avatar movie, Fire and Ash. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:48. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, author Dan Brown is known for storylines that delve into myth and conspiracy theories. His new book, The Secret of Secrets, tackles the ultimate mystery, human consciousness. Coming up at 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. 7 o'clock, On the River, it's a great mix of music. Your volunteer host tonight is Deborah Ann. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. We also thank Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community for the community. Patchy fog tonight and early tomorrow morning. Our lows overnight, 49 to 56. Mostly cloudy to start tomorrow, then becoming sunny with highs in the low to mid 70s. Support comes from the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Militici, new music from the old country. Sam Miltich and his friends will take the stage Saturday, September 13th, 7 p.m. Tickets available at the door. Info at edgecenterarts.org. Thanks to our listeners, we have raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. You can donate or share our work. Visit KAXE.org. Greater Lakes Performing Arts and Pequot Lakes Community Theater present Annie September 18th through the 28th at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Thursday and Saturday shows at 7 o'clock, Sunday matinees at 2. More news is next.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Robert Langdon is back in action. The dashing and brilliant Harvard professor who has a knack for wandering into situations where he unearths big philosophical questions and at the same time gets chased around by bad guys who do not want those questions answered. Langdon is, of course, the recurring main character in author Dan Brown's thrillers, The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, and many others. In Brown's latest novel, The Secret of Secrets, Langdon has traded the mysteries of Christianity and the mysteries of Freemasonry for the even bigger mystery of the nature of human consciousness. Dan Brown, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me.
So this is, by my count, your sixth book starring Robert Langdon. How has he changed over the years?
Well, he's aging much more slowly than I am, I've sensed. this book took 8 years to write, and Langdon, who is always, he's always skeptical about all things conspiratorial and paranormal and all that sort of stuff. And in this book, he is sort of dragged out of his comfort box by a noetic scientist named Catherine Solomon, and he becomes a believer in aspects of consciousness that to most of us, myself included, seem quite out of this world.
I want to ask about the topic of the book. How much were you personally thinking about these big questions of consciousness? Was that how the book started out? Is that something you were wrestling with or wondering about and wanting to learn more about?
Absolutely. I mean, it's no secret I like to write about big, sweeping, important topics. You know,
yeah.
There really is no topic bigger that I can imagine than consciousness. It's the lens through which we see reality, see ourselves, see our interactions with other people. And I wrote the character Catherine Solomon maybe 10 or 12 years ago as an ancillary character in another book, and she was a noetic scientist. And through the research for that book, I started to learn about noetic science and some of these mind experiments who have results that are simply, you cannot believe them. You hear what the result is and you say, that's impossible. And you read more and you find out that reality is a much stranger thing than we ever imagined.
For those of us who aren't as familiar, can you briefly explain noetic science?
Noetic science is it's the study of consciousness and more specifically the study of how the human mind can affect physical matter. It has really taken me almost two decades to learn enough to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's a rapidly evolving field.
Yeah.
So you're constantly playing catch up. But yeah, this is a topic that I'm fascinated with, and it is relevant to every single person on earth.
Yeah.
The Da Vinci Code resonated with Christians and people who thought a lot about religion. This, you know, we all fear death. It is the great unknown and that sort of catch-22 question where we're all going to find out the answer. We just can't get back to tell anybody what it is.
How much time do you spend thinking about that? Because that's something a character says at one point, that interest in consciousness comes directly from fear of dying or worry about dying.
I started this book in a very skeptical place, skeptical of a lot of this science and some of these new ideas about consciousness. And I came out the other end with a totally changed point of view. And I've changed dramatically in my view of death. I no longer fear death at all. I'm in no hurry. I love life.
Yeah.
But and probably not coincidentally, my mom died 8 years ago, right as I started this book. And it really was a catalyst as I started to learn more and more about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences and some of the physics that is really suggesting, if not proving, that our consciousness can survive the death of our physical body, which of course has enormous implications for everyone on a personal level.
Can I ask, since so many characters in the book ask each other this, do you believe that at this point?
I do. And 8 years ago, I would have given you a totally different answer. I would have said, death is the end, full stop, total blackness, the end.
Yeah.
You've basically cut the cable to the computer and it's off. You asked me today, and I'm 100% convinced that the consciousness, whether you want to call it the soul or the whatever you want to call it, your consciousness will survive beyond your physical death. And, you know...
That's a high level of certainty for the biggest unknown in existence.
You know what? It is. And I should also stress, I have not had a spiritual experience. I have not had an out-of-body experience, a religious experience. This is simply based on enormous amounts of reading and conversations with specialists in the field, as well as people who have had these experiences and are really walking their talk. They come back from out-of-body experiences and change their lives in fascinating ways.
Lastly, getting back to Robert Langdon's day job, which shows up in your books more than other professor day jobs shows up in movies. Would you, if you were a college student, would you rather be in Professor Langdon's class or Professor Indiana Jones's class?
You know what? I think you would win either way. any teacher that can incite a bit of curiosity in his or her students is doing a pretty good job.
There you go. That was author Dan Brown. His new book, Secret of Secrets, is out today. Thank you so much.
And thanks so much for having me.
Today, 20 dance projects from around the country won grants of up to $100,000 each. The announcement comes from the National Dance Project. These grants are among the most coveted in the dance world, but this round of winners is the last of its kind. That's due to a funding shortage. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has more.
Winners announced today include Brooklyn ballroom dancer and choreographer Courtney Balenciaga Washington, the Rosie Herrera Dance Theater in Miami Beach, Florida, and a project by Baltimore curator and choreographer Rashida Bumbre, honoring North Carolina blues woman Aljamae Hinton.
Hey, girl, oh, hey, do-
These are some of the most important dance grants in the United States, and without them, companies and artists may not be able to tour, says choreographer and dancer Kimberly Bartosik. She received a National Dance Project grant earlier this year.
Touring in the United States is very, very hard because it's expensive, and most presenters don't have money to bring a large group or even a small group to their communities.
The National Dance Project has given out more than $51 million in grants to more than 800 artists across the country. But the Mellon Foundation said it won't support new grants after this year. Mellon said in a statement that it ended its funding in order to support a wider range of grantees in the dance field. Bartosik says dance has never been a big moneymaker. It often takes grants, commissions, and artist residencies to make ends meet. She says now, with cuts to the National Endowment for the Arts and universities, the dance ecosystem is more fragile than ever.
It really is a system of barely threaded together structures. If we take that thread and we break it, that is where free fall exists.
The New England Foundation for the Arts, which runs the National Dance Project, says it's trying to figure out how to keep the grant program going. The other lead funder, the Doris Duke Foundation, has told them it plans to continue its support. Doris Duke is also a financial supporter of NPR. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXZ Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXZ Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can find us at KAXZ.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. Support comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, a two-day gathering to explore belonging and work.